Lehigh Valley Public Radio is proud to present HealthBeat, a spotlight on healthcare in the Lehigh Valley, produced in conjunction with the Dorothy Ryder Poole Healthcare Trust and the Ryder Poole Foundation.
Good evening and welcome to HealthBeat, a program that examines how we as a community can create a healthier Lehigh Valley. I'm Greg Caponia, along with Edward Meehan, the Executive Director of the Ryder Poole Foundation. And I'm joined by Ronald Dendis, the Program Officer at Ryder Poole Trust and Foundation. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good evening, Greg. Well, Greg, it's always good to be with you.
Tonight we're going to discuss housing and health and how this environment leads to social determinants of health. Gentlemen, you've provided me with the following statement. Most Americans spend about 90% of their time indoors, and an estimated two-thirds of that time is spent in the home. Very young children spend even more time at home and especially are vulnerable to household hazards. And that information comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Edward, housing insecurity, it's a broad and complex issue. Can you help us understand where it comes from and define the term housing insecurity?
I'd be happy to, Greg. It is a broad and complex topic, and but I think in some ways people can recognize it pretty readily, and then as you get into a deeper dive, it becomes a little more complex. Just as a way of background, I have a background in public health, and jumping back now, a couple of centuries ago, there was a huge cholera outbreak in London. And at the time, cholera was thought to be a result of bad air. And so no one understood what to do about cholera except to try to protect yourself from the bad air. And people who were wealthy could do that, and people who weren't wealthy could not. But clearly, cholera was not about bad air. It's waterborne. We know that now. We're so sophisticated.
Right.
So a physician named John Snow had a completely different idea. Where what he did was he took basically a map of the city of London and started to plot out where people who contracted cholera lived. And he started to map that out, which is not something anybody thought about previously. That mapping then led him to the question of, when I map out where people live and who's contracting cholera, what do they have in common? What he was able to draw the conclusion was what they had in common was they all used a water pump, the Broad Street water pump, and he didn't know the mechanism for the transmittal of the disease, but he understood that if you drank from that water pump, you'd have cholera. The solution at the time was he took away the pump handle. So without the lack of knowing the pure science of it, the father of epidemiology, as he's called, had figured out it's this water supply. I remove the pump handle, people won't get cholera. So when we talk about the topic of housing and health, it's very natural to kind of follow that sort of inquisitive sort of sense of, what is the connection with housing and health? So three different pieces to that, really. One is insecurity of housing, the burden on the cost of housing, what the implications are for the amount of money you're paying out of your monthly money that you have for housing, and how does that create insecurity in other ways in your life? The second is straight to John Snow's work, the physical and environmental condition within the homes, water supply, safety and security of the housing conditions, other environmental factors within the home. And then the third is conditions not just in the home, but in the surrounding neighborhood. What is the stability of the neighborhood in which that family resides? You could have a wonderful home set up for your family, but once you step out that apartment door, what are the conditions and how stable is the neighborhood in which you live? So for us, the question of housing and health kind of focuses on those issues of insecurity, the physical environment, and the conditions in the surrounding neighborhood. And as health guys, we mainly are focusing on safe and healthy housing.
Edward, I think you just described where we are today.
Ironically, from 1854 to today, we're so much more sophisticated in some ways, and in other ways, still struggling through connections and relationships as we talk about social determinants of health, the effects of housing on education, on health, on public safety, et cetera, et cetera.
So, Ronald, follow up on Edward's story and talk about our pandemic and give us a look on how we're similar in fighting the same issues with cholera or the way they did.
Well, as far as, you know, conditions of the home, we have scenarios where there's mold, there's mildew, there in some instances radon, in some instances, you know, hot water that isn't well managed or controlled. If I'm on the third floor of an apartment and you know, I'm depending on that water heater in the basement, I don't know if I'm going to get 200-degree water coming out or 40-degree water coming out.
Interesting that the water issue seems to be still with us. It's all about getting potable water, right? A lot of this?
That's going to be an important component of this.
And can it be warm? Can it be cold? Can it be clean? Ed? Sometimes when we read about housing insecurity, we immediately go to the area of homelessness, and that's not really what it means, is it?
Homelessness is a huge problem. It's a national problem. In some of the larger cities, you know, my daughter, youngest daughter, lives in Denver. It's a real issue. So that's an important subject. But if you focus exclusively on homelessness, you're missing a much larger question of housing security, safe and healthy housing that extends way beyond the immediate crunch of homeless people. With regard to housing insecurity and the cost and burden of housing, there are people who are, a little bit insecure in their housing conditions. And then just seeing as how I keep bringing up history today, you know, my dad was in a poor family, the youngest of eight kids with no mom and dad. And he used to tell the story about how they lived in 13 different apartments in 12 months because they were trying to keep ahead of the rent. That still exists today. That's not ancient history. And so those kinds of insecurities are just, you know, you're just an electric bill away from homelessness, or you're just one monthly rent payment away from homelessness. So those can be addressed as part of a safe and healthy housing approach. And again, as we've mentioned, the quality of the housing stock is an issue, as well as the neighborhood in which the housing is located.
I don't think a lot of people realize how often some families move. I saw a story on a video program where a young person was talking about this was his 22nd home in 18 years. How does that happen? What's the driver behind that? And you talked about it in your own experience with your father, Ed.
There's no pride here for my dad. It was him and his brothers and sisters keeping one step ahead of the landlord. I think in the modern day, I think there are folks. First of all, I just want to say something about that, Greg, because you're not talking necessarily about transients, and we hear that expression a lot as transients, we don't know what to do about that, and that's why we can't work with these families or work with these children. We have found, when we've looked at some of the work that we've done at the neighborhood level, particularly in Allentown, transients might mean moving five blocks away, because you have a little bit more money and you can afford a slightly better apartment. So while there's transients, while there are people who are moving, they're moving and still residing within the same school district. They might be still residing in the same census tract. So I just want to put out there that transients, for me, is a little bit of a red herring to say we can't do anything because these folks move around so much. That said, I'd also mention that when we've done neighborhood-level work, in some of the neighborhoods in Allentown, once again, the folks who rent had on average residents in the same location about 3.5 years. Now, that for someone who might have lived in the same home for 25, 30 years, that might not seem like a lot. But in 3.5 years, you can have a child go through middle school. You could have a child go through early childhood education. So there's for by and large, for most people, there is stability. Now, that said, there are people who are having difficulty, making means met, and they are mobile. Why are they mobile? They're trying to find a better quality of life for their family. They're trying to do the best thing they can, and sometimes that requires moving more than most of us are accustomed.
Let's talk about, as long as we're on history here, were there any positive things that came out of the cholera outbreak and the flu epidemic of almost 100 years ago? Is there something that we can say, well, this pandemic will make us better this way, or focus more light on our situation in a certain way? Ed?
With cholera, with John Snow, he became known as the father of epidemiology, because suddenly there was an inquisitive sort of way of looking at pathways to disease that were a little more than just, oh, it's bad air. And that's the creation of modern epidemiology and public health. With the flu pandemic of 1918, I think lessons were learned about sanitary conditions and the transmittal of disease. I think we probably could have borrowed a few more pages from the flu epidemic of 1918 in our COVID response. I think the book hasn't been written yet on how poorly or well we did with COVID, and probably in a couple of years. We know for a fact, and we've talked about this before, that what COVID has done is just rip the veil off of all the underlying conditions that impact a real disparity in health status. So the folks who are the most vulnerable, the least capable to be able to protect themselves or take care of themselves during COVID, because of a number of other existing social determinants, were the ones who were most at risk, which were the ones who are most susceptible. I think when the book gets written, it will expose the fact that we just can't go back to same old pre-COVID. We're going to have to think much longer and harder about things like housing conditions as they relate to health. And I think COVID is just going to just amplify that.
When we look at the psychological aspect of pandemics or epidemics, we've seen some resistance to the idea that there is one, it's just been an interesting experience. In the past pandemics and epidemics, was there the same type of psychological resistance to denial, maybe? And maybe not. I'm just curious. Ed?
I've read casually read that during the flu epidemic in the early 1900s, that there all this, human behavior hasn't changed. So yes, there was a great deal of that, and I think there's a certain level of disbelief that happens just when you're in these momentous kinds of global things. As human beings, I think we kind of, it takes us a while to say, oh, wait a minute, that happened, or this is happening. I think of the John Gardner line about history never feels like history when you're living through it. It's always awkward and uncomfortable.
Yes.
You guys bring up a really, interesting point about looking at history, because not only do we need to look at the history of the disease, but I think it's really important as we start looking at solutions for how do we address housing insecurities, we really need to understand the history of that neighborhood. How did that neighborhood get in the situation that it's in? I don't think we can just assume, oh, there's housing insecurities here, here's what we need to do, without knowing the history of how that neighborhood evolved, how that neighborhood got to the situation that it's in now, what the causes were, and how we make sure we're not repeating history as we try and improve housing security.
Thanks, Ron. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about the Lehigh Valley and get into some specifics about our local situation. You are listening to WDIY Health Beat.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax-deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY, Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11, offers many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus Swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the Bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
Welcome back to HealthBeat. We're speaking with Edward Meehan and Ronald Dundas of the Ryder Poole Foundation. Ronald, the adverse childhood experiences that one might have during the early life, can you talk to us about it?
Sure. There's extensive research out there that shows that children that have experienced three or more traumatic events during their brain development are much more likely to develop a chronic disease as an adult. And we know that, traumatic events could be abuse, they could be, witnessing violence, they could be neglect. One of the traumatic experiences as a young child, if you have moved more than three times in a five-year period, that's considered a traumatic event. So right off the bat, as we're talking about families moving around to stay ahead of the landlord or to try and make a better life for themselves, three of these events for a young child is considered traumatic, which is going to put them at higher risk for chronic disease as an adult. And the science behind this is just remarkable.
Is it psychological or is it more physical?
It's both. It's both. The security of house. I mean, you learn as a young child, your room supposedly is a safe place for you to be. And so there's certainly a psychological aspect of it. The science goes into the development, the brain development of your immune system, and how when your body is dealing with trauma, your brain robs the development part of the immune part of your brain to address the trauma, the fear that you're going through. So children that have experienced a lot of trauma have a less developed immune system than other children.
So the survival instinct kicks in and overrides the development process.
Yes. Yeah, the development of the immune part of system of your brain. Yes, that's what I'm not a brain surgeon. I'm not a brain scientist. But my understanding of the work that's being done is, yes, that's the correlation that's being made.
Well, you have very good data. You have access to very good data. Let's talk about the cost burden on housing insecurity. So 31% of households in the Lehigh Valley use more than 30% of their income for housing. So if you're in one of these $10 an hour jobs, or $15 an hour, that means that $600, $750 are going to your housing after taxes. You might be left with $250 a week, maybe, if you're lucky, to raise your family or survive. Is that pretty common across the country, or is that unique to the Lehigh Valley? Edward, do you have a thought on that?
Yes, I don't think it's unique to the Lehigh Valley. I think it's across the country. I think it's increasingly, an issue with families, particularly with young families. And the implications, as you say, are if you're spending more than 30% of your income for housing, that puts a damper on your food choices and your accessibility and availability for food and any number of things, a winter coat for the kids or whatever it might be. It's not unique to the Lehigh Valley, but we own that responsibility for the people we serve in the Lehigh Valley.
And in Allentown, that number grows to 45%, correct?
Correct, yes.
And so yes. Once again, that leaves insufficient resources for health care, food, heat, transportation. It also cycles you back into certain neighborhoods, right, Ed?
Absolutely. And as we've discussed in the past, when you look at health and the quality of life for the Lehigh Valley, by and large, it's very, very good. It's not till you begin to do a deeper dive and a drill down at the census tract level, at the neighborhood level, where the disparities become exposed. And you can see, wait a minute, these are the neighborhoods where folks are spending 45% of their income on housing. And the ripple effect of the choices that get limited. When I hear anecdotally from time to time, people say, well, why didn't that family just do X or just do Y? You don't understand. Their range of options were so much more inhibited by their circumstances that they had. So you really have to kind of stop and think about, okay, what are the choices that people can make within the constraints that they have? You're spending a lot of money on your home, on a domicile, then clearly you don't have the discretion.
Ron, what's the biggest misconception we have about people who are facing housing insecurity? I'm seeing a lot of nice cars rolling up the food banks.
I think there are a lot of misconceptions around housing insecurities. Certainly the fact that as Ed was mentioning before, people have options. Well, just get a better job. Well, just work more overtime. You've got these cyclical scenarios. Let's take a scenario of a single parent household with a child with pediatric asthma. Now, we know that the child spending time in that house is if the housing condition is poor, there's mold, there's mildew, there are things that aggravate that child's asthma. In order for parent to address child's asthma, parent needs to take child to doctor. That's going to cost money. Do I have that money? The solution to some of the care is going to be things like,
inhalers.
For it. Thank you. And that costs money. And so how am I going to get this up? I'm afraid to take my child. So I'm going to leave my child at home, which is going to exacerbate his or her asthma even more because of the conditions. If I want to take that child to work, it means I have to take a day off from, if I want to take the child to a doctor, it means I have to take a day off from work.
Right.
That means I'm going to lose a day's pay, which is going to put another burden on this work. And because the child is too sick to go to school, child's going to miss a day, 2 days, 3 days of learning. That's going to happen several times during a marking period. That's going to create a social determinant of education.
I didn't mean to pick on people who have good transportation, but a lot of people who find themselves in this position, I don't think expected to find themselves in this position.
Nobody said, here's my life plan. I'm going to live in substandard housing and be challenged by how to get my kid to the doctor.
So, Edward, 64 million people in the United States live in multi-generational households. That's prompted by, cultural, economic, and a lot of other factors. We don't really build for multi-generational structures, do we? And that is something that can help housing insecurity, perhaps?
Yeah, it's interesting if you think about it. Multi-generational probably was the norm, since we keep talking about history. If you go back two or three or four generations, wouldn't have been that unusual. And if it wasn't multi-generational under one roof, Nana and Grandpa lived, maybe a few blocks away. Folks tended to live in the neighborhoods in which they grew up, so there was a lot of stability. There was a cohesiveness. And let's just say in the last two generations, maybe more, maybe post-World War II probably, we became a much more mobile society. We became a much more suburban society. We chose to live in housing and seek out housing that was single family, that was, kind of family unit and not multi-generational, multi-family. And post-COVID in this next iteration, do we go back to saying, maybe Nana should live with us, or, hey, our 24-year-old is having a little difficulty or the jump start, not unusual for most folks in their 20s these days just because of the economy, et cetera. I wonder how that will work. Will we start seeing housing that starts to go back to kind of an old ethos of, yeah, of course you live in a multi-generational situation, or at least you construct the neighborhood societal cultural factors that would give you a sense of community to support that.
In the Lehigh Valley, there are some ways to help people who do have this housing insecurity and have questions. I was talking with Phillips Armstrong, the Lehigh County executive, recently, and he was talking about the Public Defender's Office having a food bank along with a legal aid desk where all the PDs come out and answer questions. And he said most of the questions have to do with housing. And that's a terrific thing that they do. What other things are there for people who just don't know what their rights might be as a resident in a rental property? Ron?
North Penn Legal Services, our local legal aid society, does a remarkable job of tenant rights and providing legal advice and legal services to those that are struggling with some of these issues. CAC, the Community Action Committee of Billy High Valley, CATLV, is another incredible advocate for tenant rights.
And if you don't have, or if you know somebody who has questions about housing and their rights, these public defenders are available at any time to reach out to, and these agencies are available at any time to reach out to. So if you know anybody who has these types of questions, please make sure you direct them to these areas. They can be very helpful. It can be questions as light as, let's say you think you have lead paint in a house that you're renting, crumbling infrastructure, bugs, anything like that. What else can people who are more fortunate do to help less fortunate people in this area? Ed?
Oh, I think there are any number of really fine not-for-profit organizations that are doing great work and supporting families in ways to, again, homelessness is an issue, but how do we keep people from being in a situation where they are homeless and so many people live in fragile conditions? Without naming names, because I wouldn't want to forget anybody, there are any number of really fine organizations that if someone wanted to volunteer time or donate, it would be pretty easy to find one that you would find appealing.
We're closing in on the end of our show. Ronald, do you have any things that you'd like to say to people who are facing the thought that they might be, dealing with housing insecurity?
Well, I think it's important to note as we try and help folks, understand that options become really, really important here, or the lack of options. Oftentimes we want to go into homes and say, look, there are zoning violations here. There are housing condition violations here. We're going to shut this place down. And oftentimes we're in situations where we're saying, oh my God, I'm trying to address the mildew and the mold and the violations are going to cause this person to be homeless. And so they're actually, what's worse, being in an unhealthy, unsafe house or not having that at all? And oftentimes that becomes the option so that, the residents are saying, look, where I live, is not good, but it's better than being out on the streets. So, how we go in and help folks, I think we have to be extremely careful and sensitive to the needs of those particular residents, because you start looking at violations and shutting places down, and people don't have options of where to go.
Edward, final thoughts as the Ryder Pool Foundation does so much to help people in need.
We talked about John Snow and epidemiology and looking to find patterns and trying to understand better. We need to apply that same inquisitive sense to health and housing. We need better data. We need better analytics. And Ron and I are working hard to work with colleagues to say, how do we get smarter about this from what the data tells us, so that we can tell a more accurate story and have better science behind the work to help people.
I'd also like to add that if you know somebody who is facing issues with their housing in the Lehigh Valley, just go to a search engine and type in housing insecurity Lehigh Valley, and a number of options will pop up. And gentlemen, thank you very much for a very informative show and a little historical look at epidemiology. I thank you very much.
Always good to be with you, Greg.
Once again, we are speaking with Edward Meehan and Ronald Dendis from the Ryder Pool Foundation. This has been Health Beat. I'm your host, Greg Caponia. And you are listening to WDIY. Have a good evening.
Lehigh Valley Public Radio is proud to present Health Beat, a spotlight on healthcare in the Lehigh Valley, produced in conjunction with the Dorothy Ryder Poole Healthcare Trust and the Ryder Poole Foundation.